I owe so much to Owen Barfield in terms of, it is like the central insight of his life. And it has, I suppose it's been one of the two or three things that's been the guiding light for me. Carla and I and our youngest son, Jamie, went to India in 1999 for a semester, and I taught at a Presbyterian Theological Seminary in Dehradun. And you remember who Hans Ruckmacher is? He worked with Francis Schaeffer. He was an art critic. And he was very much a, he and Schaeffer were like Paul and Tom. They were really with one another, had each other's backs, worked together. And Ruckmacher, as an art critic, used to say, we don't know what we see what we know. And I was immensely grateful that before I had gone to India, I had read Rosenstock Husey, who I mentioned yesterday, and that I had read Owen Barfield. Because I don't think I could have seen or understood the things that we got immersed in while we were in India, especially if I had not read Owen Barfield. Now, Barfield, if you don't know who he is, he was part of the Inkling group. He was a good friend of C.S. Lewis's. Lewis always said that Owen Barfield was his alter ego. Who was it that was his, he said he was my, the same as me, his childhood friend, you remember? Arthur, I don't remember his last name, but he said we were like the same person practically. But Owen Barfield, he was my alter ego, and he said it is as if we spoke the same language, but Owen Barfield mispronounced every word. And he said every idea I had, he had almost the counter opposite. He said we went tooth and nail, day and night, year in and year out. He said, but the truth is Owen Barfield ended up influencing me a lot. And Barfield was one of the people who was very central to his own conversion when he finally became a Christian. So Barfield was a philologist. You know what a philologist is? Studies language. Lewis's opinion of him was very high. He said Barfield displayed genius. And Barfield had one, really it was one great insight that he spent his whole life working out. And it was something that he said he first discovered in language. Now, he said, what would you do? His own testimony as to how he came into the Christian faith. He said, the way I came to the Christian faith was very different from C.S. Lewis. He said, with Lewis, it was a matter of, well, it was a whole series of things, but rational apologetics had a good deal to do with Lewis actually finally coming to Jesus Christ and owning him as the Lord of all of creation. Barfield said, what would you do? And he described his own situation. He said, if you were raised in a middle-class British home, you went to church three times a year, Christmas, Easter, and Pentecost, Whitsuntide, and you had never read the Bible for yourself until you were an adult or in university, and you had been raised to believe that the Gospels were noble myths and little more, although noble myths, and certainly our civilization owes a great deal to them. Said, then when I became a philologist and was at university, he said, I read the Gospels first for myself. And he said, the more I studied language, the more it became clear to me. And here, once again, you see, I'm putting a timeline up here, and everything I did yesterday was with a timeline. And maybe all of this is in my own soul, traceable back to Barfield, who taught me this. He said somewhere between about the 3rd century B.C. and the 3rd century A.D., something happened to language. And it happened apparently somewhere in the Middle East. You can trace it out in the evolution of languages. And the more he studied it, he said, the more it began to appear, it happened almost about in the middle of that time between three centuries on either side of this. And then he said, then I read the Gospels, and what the Gospels told me were that a man came down from heaven, and he said he was the Word, and he said things like, it's not what goes into a man, but what goes out of a man that is significant. And that, I'll explain to you how this works, but he said that actually is exactly what he saw happening in language. He said, what would you do? This was shattering to him when he made this discovery. He said, well, probably you would do the same thing I did, and that is you would submit yourself to this man as who he said he was, and that's why he became a Christian. It was because of his philological studies. So he said what he discovered was that all ancient languages work from the outside in. All modern languages work from the inside out. And I'll give you a couple of illustrations of this. I'll give you two linguistic illustrations. Not being a philologist and not having recently read Barfield, I can't give you dozens of linguistic illustrations. I'll give you some other simpler illustrations, but here are two linguistic illustrations. Anybody got enough Hebrew under their belt to know what ruha means? What's ruha? Breath. Very good. Breath or spirit. He said, so here, how is it? And Barfield said, if you study etymologies, this is where etymology has become very significant. If you study etymologies, he said, this is how all metaphors in the modern world have arisen. So just to give this as an example, ruha, which means breath, where does it start? How did it develop? Well, first of all, it was wind. And wind, of course, is out there. You can feel it. And then the wind comes into you. It becomes your own breath. It comes from the outside, comes to me on the inside. And then finally, it is transformed from wind into what would be the final illustration as it moves inward, as it becomes personal, if you will. What would that be? Spirit. Becomes spirit. Exactly the same thing would be true with pneuma, the Greek word. Pneumatic hammer is an air hammer, right? Exactly the same way. Exactly the same way language developed in Greek. The wind is out there, then it comes into you as your breath, and then it's transformed linguistically into the spirit. And we see this all Trinitarian language, the third person of the Trinity is the Spirit, who is also the wind of God. Well, virtually anything that is a metaphor in modern language, that is how it developed. It all started out there, and it all eventually moves in, and then eventually it's transformed somehow in the human mind or the human spirit into something that is an internal or spiritual reality. One that comes to mind is to be supercilious. Well, to be supercilious is to raise the eyebrows. And actually, he carries this, I happen to remember supercilious, is raising the eyebrows. But that actually even goes out to something that was further out. I don't remember what. But he's got dozens of these, dozens and dozens. And he says there's all ancient languages work from the outside in. All modern languages work from the inside out. So let me give you, I'll give you two more illustrations. And actually when Jim and I have taught together, Jim used, you may have heard some of these from Jim because I actually stole this from Jim a long time ago when I heard him use this illustration. What's the name of the Chicago football team? The Bears. Okay, name some other team names for me that are animals. Lions. The Lions, the Panthers, the Eagles. The Ravens. Okay. Now, where does all that come from? All comes from tribal peoples. Tribal peoples all have totems. Now, not all tribal peoples have totems that look exactly alike. What's a totem? Tell me about totems. What's a totem look like? A totem what?
Pole.
And what is that?
Carved animals.
Carved animals, okay. And part, yes, often it carries the history of the tribe. And you will have, we'll just make one up. The top is an eagle, then you've got a lion, then you've got a bear, or you've got a wolf, and you've got a coyote or a mountain lion or any of these animals are animals that are, if usually they have warrior qualities. And all of these qualities are qualities that the tribal people take into themselves. So let's say you belong to the bear tribe. What happens to you? It's a psychic process that I think is literally impossible for modern people. We've lost this capacity. But if you belong to the bear tribe, what happens to you when you go into battle? What do you literally become the bear. You literally become the bear. Or if you look at any Indian tribe, at least the Westerns, okay, if I'm a warrior in any Indian tribe, we got two eagle feathers here. If I'm the chief, I got what? Oh, whole headdress with maybe several hundred. Now, why would an Indian warrior have an eagle feather? What does that mean? Pardon?
He's part of the tribe.
He's part of the tribe, but what? Why the eagle? What's special about the eagle? He soars above, and also, what sense is extraordinarily keen in the eagle or a hawk? Sight. Or, you know, owls are the same. They can sight. They can see anything. So if I am a hawk or I am an eagle, and especially see if I become the chief, then I have taken into myself all of these qualities, this quality of the eagle. And actually, you know, tribesmen, somebody was telling me this not too long ago. There are five planets that are visible to the human eye, and my friend was telling me that Australian Aborigines, literally, they can see the moons around, is it Jupiter? I don't remember. Something that isn't, well, partly because you're out in the desert and the atmosphere was very clear. And so, but it's these tribal people had certain capacities that we have lost. I mean, they could smell, they could see, they could hear acutely in ways that we have lost. And it was all in terms of taking all of the powers of the creation into themselves. Okay? You following what I'm saying? So if I'm an Indian chief, I'm the chief because I soar higher than anyone, I can see further than anyone, and therefore I am authorized, or I am, if you will, I'm the executive of the whole tribe. I rule the tribe. I command the tribe because I have more of this quality than anyone else, although every warrior has this quality. Otherwise, you wouldn't be a warrior. Now, what Barfield uncovered was the reality that the early human race, and by the way, so I don't blather on, just because I can blather on for forever. What's my time frame here? How long do I?
9:30.
Okay, I got to go fast. Good night. Okay. All right. The early human race existed by taking all of the powers of the creation into itself. It absorbed those powers. It absorbed those qualities. And if you think about all ancient peoples, this is what they are doing. So it doesn't matter if you the animal world is the easiest place to see it with tribal peoples, but this was the occupation of the human race for thousands of years. And it would appear that one of the things that could not happen was that Jesus could not come until the human race had taken into itself an adequate amount of the powers of humanity and it absorbed them into itself. This is how human consciousness grew. I'm just talking about tribal peoples here now. With empire peoples, they would take other things into themselves, but I take all of these animal powers into myself and they actually make human consciousness grow. Now, when we were in India, this was exactly the kind of quality that we experienced. And what you sense when you are in some of these places is that you are literally living with a different kind of human being than exists in the Western world. And you could feel it, although if you didn't have some clue ahead of time, you wouldn't know what it was that you were feeling. Now, the occupation, this was happening with the whole of the human race. What would be the temptation if you were, say, a tribal people or any ancient people, and what your occupation is to take into yourself all of the powers of the creation and make them a part of your own consciousness? What would your temptation be? Exactly, idolatry. So not only do I take the powers of the eagle into myself, or the powers of the bear, but I'm very tempted to make a god out of the bear or the lion or whatever, or see the bear as a representative of that power, which I then fall down before. But yes, the temptation of all ancient peoples was to worship the creation. Now Israel, God puts Israel into the world. These Jewish people, the Israelis, the Hebrews, and their occupation likewise is to take everything in the creation into themselves. If you look at the temple or the tabernacle, what's the occupation of a priest? A priest is to take the powers of the creation into himself and then offer them up to God. So Israel's occupation or Israel's vocation was similar to the whole of the, it was the same as the whole of the ancient world, except they were to correct the idolatry of the ancient world. So instead of worshiping the powers that existed in the cosmos around them, they were instead supposed to offer those up as a priestly people to God. But as they did this, what you find is that human consciousness and human capacities and human powers grow. In other words, you grow by becoming like the creation. All the powers God has put in the creation are taken into you as a race. But with this difference, Israel doesn't worship the creation, at least it's not supposed to. And the rest of it has this occupation of purity. The rest of the world also has this command, but doesn't know as much as Israel. So their temptation to simply fall into idolatry is almost complete. When Jesus comes, Jesus represents the fullness of Israel. He is the true Israeli, right? He is the true Jew. He is the final remnant. You want to know who the remnant of Israel is? The remnant of Israel is Jesus. He's the final remnant. Jesus is also the one who comes at the point that the human race has absorbed into itself, if you will, the fullness of the creation. So when Jesus comes, one of the things he represents, it's something we don't think about, and Barfield makes this point very handily and very well, is that Jesus has also taken into himself the fullness of all of the powers of creation, and he offers them up to God on the cross. And when he offers them up to God on the cross in atonement, he is actually the foundation of a new heaven and a new earth. It's because he's taken it all into himself. Now, following Jesus, after Jesus comes, and this is Barfield's point, it is as if something happens and things begin to be reversed. And instead of the human race taking the powers of the creation into itself, the human race begins to project its own mindset out onto the creation. So I'll give you a very simple example of this. And this became really, we could really see this when we were in India. If we look at the tribal peoples, when they relate to animals, they want to take the power of the animal into themselves. How do we relate to animals?
We eat them.
Well, we eat them, yeah, but they did too. When they ate them, though, they were taking their power, the power of that. For the same reason that if a warrior, say from the bear tribe, kills a warrior from the wolf tribe, one of the things he might do is slice that gentleman open and do what? Eat his heart, eat his liver, drink his blood, precisely so he can take all of his fierce warrior qualities into himself. Okay, now, how many of you would really like to be like a Great Dane? How many of you have that as your ideal, to be like a great German Shepherd? How many of you, raise your hand if you want to be a German Shepherd. All right, if you have a dog at home, what's your relationship with that dog? Well, it's even more than that. Yeah, friendship. How many of you, when you go home, tell your dog meets you at the door and he understands everything about you? How many of you, your dog is better than a bartender? Huh? How many, when you watch animated cartoons on television, what typically makes up those animations?
We talk with your animals.
Yeah, they're talking animals. So Donald Duck stands up on his hind legs. They never have pants on, but he's got a shirt on, he's got a hat on, and he talks. In other words, we project ourselves onto the animal. We don't take the animal into ourselves, we project ourselves onto the animal, right? Now, this was, when I was in India, I remember there was a big stack of books, Agatha Christie novels. There was not much else to do at night, so I read these Agatha Christie novels, and one of them, Agatha Christie, she dedicated her book to her dog, Peter, who she said was the wisest of counselors, the best of friends, and she goes on and on about how wonderful Peter is. Well, I remember telling my students this in one of the classes. I was talking about how we as Westerners relate to her, and it was like, you talk about, what? Completely puzzled faces. In India, if you were a dog, you were, your dog owes as much to Jesus as you do. If there is no place in the third world where you would so much as have a dog in your house. A dog is an unclean animal who you might keep in order to keep visitors away or to keep criminals away to bark. But the idea that you would somehow project yourself onto this dog and this dog would be your friend, it was literally incomprehensible to my Indian students. They could not grasp this. And I thought to myself, the longer we were there, that this, more than anything, summed up the difference between modern people and ancient people. It just told that story more quickly and more rapidly than anything else that I knew of. So what you begin to see is that everything moves out from human consciousness and is projected onto the world instead of the world projecting itself onto us. Now, does anybody know, I'll see if I can think of an example. Anybody, do we have any, how many of you came from ranches in, say, the last couple of generations? Any ranchers here today? You came from a ranch?
No, farm.
Farm, okay.
Well,
here's the point, not necessarily. If you were to even just go back two or three generations, see, this, not all of these things have just happened overnight. Let me give this as an illustration to go back earlier. Do you think the human race has always seen landscapes? If you read, for example, Homer, there is not a single description of a landscape anywhere. The first people to paint landscapes were painters about the time of the Renaissance, and they all occupied cities. They did not live in the country. It would still be true that if you know some old rancher somewhere, and you talk to them about, oh, your ranch is so beautiful, they say, huh? They don't care. Their ranch is a place where you raise sheep, you raise cattle. There's a lot of work to do. A rancher of 300 years ago did by and large not see the landscape. The landscape was something that I'm not even sure the word invisible. It's just like it never occurred to them. There's such a thing as a landscape. That was something nobody ever saw until they were city dwellers. And then there was some sort of new consciousness. There was something that they could actually impose on the world. The very idea of nature is a relatively modern idea, something that we look out there and see. In other words, we are projecting our own sense of spiritual reality onto the world that's out there. All right. Now, I guess I could go on with that sort of illustration. I'll give you one more illustration. I'll give you a philosophical illustration. Does anybody know enough about Plato to know what did Plato say? What's the center of Plato's view of the universe? Anybody know?
The world as we know it is a fake, a dream. And the real world is the ideals.
Okay, all right. Yes, you're right. What's really, really real are forms. So up there somewhere, if you want to spatialize it, although actually it's not even spatial, but somehow if we want to talk about it, up there somewhere is the form of a table. Tableness exists in some sort of ideal world called the forms, and this table participates in it or is a representative of it. So what's really real is up there, and somehow or other we somehow participate in it. Now if you move forward to modern philosophy, and the best representative of modern philosophy is Immanuel Kant. Does Immanuel, and if you don't know this, that's fine, I'll try to explain it, but maybe somebody in here knows enough about modern philosophy to immediately grasp this. Does Immanuel Kant believe in the forms?
No, he believes that the forms are in man and in his mind.
They're in your head. Yes, he believes in the forms, but they're not up there somewhere. They're in here. Okay? It's the same thing. Everything. So for Kant, there really isn't a world that's out there. There's something out there, but it's completely unknowable. It's our mind that is actually that actually creates everything that we see out there, and we actually are imposing ourselves on the world. Now, that may sound nuts to you, and it may be nuts, but that, in fact, is the essence of modern philosophy, that we are in fact, creating the world that we see and that we live in. It doesn't just exist out there naively as we live in it and see it. However nutty that may sound to you, that's the very modern ideal. Same thing, that things are moving outward from us instead of moving into us. Have I at least sort of made what I'm talking about clear, the difference between ancient people and modern people? Does that make some sort of sense? All right. Now, here's where I want to go with this. What are we facing now? Because I want to make this application. What are we facing now? We are facing the whole dilemma of the human race up until about the day before yesterday. And really, the explosion, when I say the day before yesterday, I'm speaking, of course, in terms of centuries. I don't literally mean the day before yesterday. But the whole dilemma of the human race, the sin of the human race has been idolatry. We want to make an idol of things out there. What happened with the French Revolution, which was like, if you read descriptions of what preceded the French Revolution, it was like there was this national sense of tension that was everywhere, and then there was this, it was almost like this literal explosion. Kaboom! And the revolution happened, and there was this human transformation that took place with the French Revolution. Something very similar with the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917, this kaboom! And what happened is it is almost as if we have moved beyond the world. We have moved beyond the world. The problem that we're facing today is not with it's not with warrior tribal peoples. I mean, I'm talking about the first world, not if you go to Africa or Iraq or India, this isn't true. But I'm talking about the United States and Western Europe. What we are looking at now is several generations of people who are, it's like we are beyond the world. You have bored, sexed out, drugged out youth everywhere, and what would describe the world increasingly is boredom. Well, there's not an E in there, whatever it is boredom. The world bores us. If you read the existentialists, you read someone like Sartre, you read Heidegger, everything about them is, I am ennui. I'm so bored with everything around me. There is nothing that interests me. My freedom is the same as nothingness. Why is it that we have a world that is now sex-obsessed and drug-obsessed? Because we're looking for some sort of stimulation, and nothing in the cosmos stimulates us. See, I mean, how many video games can you play and be stimulated? There's nothing, it's like there's nothing left to do. We have exhausted the world. It took us about 2,000 years to come to the place where we have completely outgrown this, if you will. And we have now come to the place where we have taken all of the fullness of creation into ourselves. And now it's as if we're dealing with complete boredom. There's nothing that's out there that's interesting. I mean, even to travel, all the travel stories are, you know, the road trip. The whole point of all road trip books are stories. Who was it that wrote the initial, who was that, the hippie, or one of the predecessors, who was that? Kerouac, yes, on the road. The whole point of it is it's all boring. Traveling down this road, and the road is nothingness, and there's nothing that we see, and there's nothing we experience, and so you try to have this kick and that kick, but there's nothing that's interesting. It is as if sinful human beings now have moved beyond idolatry. There's nothing in the cosmos to worship. So like the Marquis de Sade, who would have been an early modern man, the Marquis de Sade, when we were in India, we literally saw people sit by the side of the road, and as the sun would rise, they would worship the sun, taking the sun into themselves, you see, the power of the sun. They're still ancient peoples. Well, the Marquis de Sade said, no, what I want to do is snatch the sun from the sky and extinguish it. We've come to hate everything that's around us. We're bored by it. We want to destroy it because that would be the only stimulating thing left. Now, how does the church minister into that? I hope I've got 3 minutes left, and I hope I've gotten to a springboard here as to, because see, what this whole conference has been taken up with is, where is the church going? The church now has to minister to people whose temptation is not idolatry, is not to worship the creation, but people who are completely bored by the creation, who are now living in a world of nothingness and are looking for any kind of stimulation, anything that would be interesting, and there's nothing interesting. So do we have any clues? Well, I think I have a clue. And that's all I can leave you with is a clue. And if you say, well, what do you mean by that, Mr. Bledsoe? I have to say, I'm not sure what I mean by that. I leave you with this clue, and for the next 50 years, maybe we can figure out some of this together. But if we look at the work of Jesus Christ, we find that the work of Jesus Christ, all aspects of redemption, every aspect of redemption is worked out in every individual and in the whole of the church all of the time. But Every generation has a special or particular need. So the simplest example I want to leave you with here as to what the church has done in the past, Martin Luther discovered what? What was it that was the transforming insight of the Reformation? Justification by faith. And why is that? Because Luther, being a thoroughly medieval man, was racked with guilt, was terrified of damnation, found God to be a terrifying judge who would cast him into hell for eternity, and he knew he deserved it. And not one of you have a neighbor anywhere who's remotely like Martin Luther. Justification by faith is just as true today as it was for Martin Luther, but it does not speak to us. Now let me suggest the place we have to go now, and the sixth verse of the second chapter of Ephesians, it says that we have been raised, the fourth verse, but God who is rich in mercy, because of his great love with which he loved us, even when we were dead in trespasses, made us alive together with Christ. By grace you have been saved, and raised us up with him together and made us sit together in the heavenly places in Christ Jesus. Now, in other words, one of the things that happens when you are in Christ, and everything happens when you're in Christ. You receive everything Christ gives to you. But what I want to suggest is the place we increasingly have to learn to go, whatever this means, I'm not sure what it means, but is that we have also been raised beyond the cosmos. The cosmos bores us. It's as if we've come to the place where we've already taken the whole of the cosmos into us. We've now projected ourselves onto the cosmos in every way imaginable. The cosmos bores us. There's only one step beyond that, and that is that we have ascended with Jesus Christ and been seated above the cosmos in the heavenly places with him. He was seated with the Father at the right hand of God. Paul tells us specifically in Ephesians and in Colossians, and the Apostle John spells this out very clearly in the book of Revelation, that in Christ we are already, although the fullness of it won't be till after judgment, but already we are seated with him in the heavenly places. And there is a sense in which, being seated with Christ in the heavenly places, we are now looking down on the cosmos as the rulers of the cosmos. In other words, we have already in Jesus Christ moved beyond the cosmos, moved beyond this world, and we're now looking down into it. Does that make even the remotest sense to you? Do you get at all what I'm saying? You know, go talk to sexed out, drugged up youth who are bored with everything about justification by faith, and they will look at you as, what? Or who cares? Or that's the most boring, stupid thing. Guilt? What are you talking about? No, this is a whole world now that's moved beyond the cosmos, but Jesus Christ has already taken us beyond the cosmos. And we now get to be with him in the heavenly places, looking down on the cosmos, and we are the rulers of the cosmos with him. There's no one else who can do that. Now, I really don't know much of what that means or how that's supposed to work itself out. But I think it's at least a clue. It's at least a clue about what our calling is as Christians. So I'll leave you with a clue. And if you're a little baffled by that, welcome to the club, because so am I. But I think it is at least a hint. Okay? So we'll end there. I went over by 90 seconds. My apologies.
Introduce yourself.